From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, Milwaukee Magazine's annual Best of Milwaukee issues features some of the city's most cherished icons and institutions.
The thing that really struck me was how it aligned with the way that we see Milwaukee. And I don't know, it felt like there were so many categories where it's like, yeah, got it. Classic Milwaukee.
Cellist Robert Cohen steps out of his musical comfort zone to discover how difficult it is to play Irish traditional music. And singer-songwriter Kaylee Conway explains how playing with a band changes her performances.
There's a much bigger rush and, like, more gratification, I would say, because you're sharing in the sentiment that you are trying to emote. When it goes really well, like, there's nothing like that feeling.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Every year, Milwaukee Magazine compiles a list of the city's most beloved institutions. The Best of Milwaukee issues features dozens of categories, like the best supper club, the best vintage shop, and of course, the best fish fry. Chris Drosner is the executive editor of Milwaukee Magazine, and he joins Joy Powers in the studio to talk about this year's list. Drosner starts by explaining how they decide what to include in their list.
The guts of the Best of Milwaukee is our Reader's Choice poll. So the way that works is we kind of decide what categories we want to spotlight, and we pick different categories every year. Some are kind of mainstays that we carry through from year to year. You know, best new restaurant is always really popular. Best lunch, some stuff like that. But we want to kind of keep it fresh, and the best of doesn't change every year. So we want to kind of have some a little bit of dynamism in the categories. So, and the winners, obviously. So we pick mostly different categories every year, and then the staff kind of nominate who we think are among the best. You know, we come up with a list of maybe 4 to 6 or 7 kind of choices for people to choose from. We post that survey on our website, and you know, I think it's the voting's open for like maybe 6 weeks or something like that. Quite a while, and there's always, of course, a write-in opportunity. I don't think we had any write-in winners this year, so that's kind of the guts of it. And then we augment with some editors' picks, and we try to kind of find ways to play with the format every year.
Yeah. So you mentioned, of course, it's mostly based on what people vote for, but one of the things you also featured inside of this piece were a number of things where the editors disagreed with what the readers chose.
Right, yes. A controversial aspect, to be sure. So, I mean, we have experts on lots of different topics on staff, and we kind of like to play up that expertise. So we had to kind of convince Ann Christensen, our dining critic, to do this, but yeah, she picked a few of her favorites within some of the categories. For example, we had the best taco, and this is one, I think this is one that was a winner last year or in recent years, Bel Air Cantina. You know, got a couple locations.
Makes a great taco. Yeah,
they do. It's a great taco, but you know, it's kind of a fusion. Some of their tacos, at least, are kind of untraditional takes on the taco. So Anne went with a very traditional taqueria, a place called Chilango Express. That was kind of the one that I was like, that is something that is definitely my bag. And that's not one, you know, I've been to Bel Air a bunch of times and I hadn't been to Chilango Express. So that's on my list now.
Yeah, it's funny. Food is such a personal thing, especially. So you look at some of the choices, and I'm sure best taco is one where you might go, oh, well, I really like vegetarian tacos. And so I go, oh, Bel Air is great for that. But if you want something that is more authentic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's one area where the semantics of it kind of, we have to be kind of careful, because Best of Milwaukee is, you know, certainly we do think this is the best of, but another way to look at it is it's the most popular in Milwaukee because it's a survey. And, you know, we had, I think it was pushing 3,000 votes in this, which is, I guess it was more than I was expecting. People really like to have their voices heard and, you know, weigh in. And on most of these things are things that people really kind of feel passionately about. So, you know, it's good to be able to kind of express that. And part of the challenge this year we did little write-ups on every winner. So that was kind of enlightening to have to if there was a winner that was kind of a surprise to us, we had to go and figure out what makes this great, you know, if we hadn't experienced it. So that was a lot of fun as well.
What were some of the surprising picks?
One of the ones that we raised an eyebrow at was 5 o'clock Steakhouse for our supper club. That was in our Wisco, internally we were calling it Wisco Classics because who has time for that extra syllable? But the Wisconsin Classics was a fun category that we kind of embraced the Wisconsin food and drink identity a little bit. But Anne was of the opinion that that was more of kind of, it's a supper club, but it felt a little bit more on the steakhouse side of things. I guess that was a little bit of a surprise. I was a little surprised at the way the musician broke down because we've got some really great, some really talented musicians in Milwaukee. The voting was happening late spring, early summer. And that was right when Trapper Shep's new album came out. And, you know, he had that great video of like all the great Wisconsin things. And I just thought the timing of that was like, oh, this is going to be a runaway. But Amanda Huff, she came out on top and she actually participated in our photo shoot, which was a lot of fun. We had BJ Daniels, which was our editor's pick as best drag queen, to kind of serve as like a mascot for all our different kind of groupings of categories, and which was art directed by our art director, Paul Higgins, and it just turned out awesome. So that was a lot of fun. And she actually took part in the shoot with BJ kind of singing into a microphone. She's got the headphones on. It was great.
I should mention Trapper Shep actually works for our program.
Oh, well, there you go.
he's our LTE producer.
Ah, excellent. Yeah. Hi, Trapper.
So looking at especially the Wisco favorites, I think there were a lot of very familiar faces, I guess I might say, but familiar places for sure. And I think they've won this category before, but Lakefront Brewery once again got best fish fry. What is it about their fish fry that is so unique or just, you know, so spectacular?
I mean, have you had it? It's, you know, they use that light beer battering. I think that's a big part of it. But to me, this is almost tied hand in hand with their beer hall, which is just a great space for that kind of food. It's like the communal seating and it's big and open. And a lot of times they've got music going on. You know, I mean, they also won another fried thing in the Wisco Classics, the cheese curds. So, you know, maybe they've got magic fryers. I'm not sure. I'll have to ask them that next time I talk to somebody over there. And I can't let this go without saying Lakefront actually won four categories. They had the curds, the fish fry, and then they had best craft brewery, and then best individual beer, which went to their River West Stein, which, you know, I mean, that's a classic. That some of these, you know, there are many beers that I could pick for like the best of Milwaukee. But that one really kind of feels like it fits. And especially when you bring in the populism element of it, might be the longest running craft beer in Milwaukee. And I mean, it's named after one of its great neighborhoods and it's just really tasty. So, yeah.
There's a whole section, of course, that is dedicated to drinking. And something that you put in there are these kinds of emerging trends that we're seeing in drinking culture. And one of the more interesting parts of it is that inside of drinking culture, and this is true both in Milwaukee but nationwide, we're seeing a rise in non-alcoholic drinks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Anne wrote about that, and that's something that is kind of, you know, she's not a huge drinker. So she kind of takes notice when these things happen. And there's something that's so appealing about the cocktail culture, and particularly the kind of the craft aspect of it with these infused syrups and, you know, a kind of narrow-use spirits, that sort of thing. I'm primarily a beer drinker, and that's really appealing to me, the idea of playing with those flavors and the combinations and the different, you know, textures and mixtures that you can get from that. And I think that is appealing to people who don't drink alcohol as well. So I think that's part of it, and, you know, it's healthier. I think that's a trend not to be overlooked in that as well.
Yeah, the healthier aspect also seems to kind of go into the hard seltzers, which are also mentioned as an emerging trend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this has been a big one this year. And when we were talking about these kind of trends were one way that we kind of filled out the category and brought some freshness to it. And seltzer it has blown up, like especially as we were putting this together this summer. It seemed like hard seltzers were just everywhere. Miller Coors had a bunch of them at Summerfest this year, but the White Claw culture just exploded. And it's not necessarily a local trend in that there is a local Wisconsin, Milwaukee-based company that does one called Press. But it was so much a part of the way the drinking culture changed this year that we felt like we couldn't ignore it.
Yeah. You know, when you look at this list just overall, what are the biggest standouts to you? I mean, we talked about things that you found surprising, but what were some of the big standouts just in general?
The thing that really struck me was how it aligned with the way that we see Milwaukee. You know, like, best place to take the kids, MPM, the public museum, you know, like, which is the way that I mean, when I came to visit my grandparents in Milwaukee 25 years ago, we would go and see the Buffalo Stampede exhibit and the snake and the I Closed Wolski's bumper sticker on the Jeep in the jungle exhibit. So that kind of traditional aspects of how all of us think about Milwaukee were really here. And then obviously there's cutting edge trends involved too. And I don't know, it felt like there were so many categories where, I mean, we talked about the surprises, but there's so many where it's like, yeah, got it. Classic Milwaukee, which was just this kind of category where we wanted to just throw out some icons of Milwaukee. And it was, you know, we didn't really explain what the categories were. It was just giving people these different options of what to vote for. And it was Summerfest. Like, of course, right? I mean, the big gig. I mean, Summerfest in particular, but all the festivals during the summer are so much a part of the city's identity. So I thought that was great, and I thought that was really well represented. I mean, I'm proud of our readers. They did a really good job on picking these things, and we played around with the We Beg to Differ thing, and that was a little cheeky, but, you know, I think it's a great representation of what's great about Milwaukee.
Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you, Joy.
Chris Drosner is the executive editor of Milwaukee Magazine, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find more of our conversations with Milwaukee Magazine at WUWM.com. Coming up right after a break, cellist Robert Cohen joins us for his regular On That Note segment. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect here on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. We all say we want change, but when we're presented with it, most of us resist it. We don't like being outside of our comfort zones, and that is true of professional creatives like musicians as it is with anyone else. Cellist Robert Cohen joins us each month to talk about the life of a touring classical musician. It's a life that he knows well. He's been performing professionally for decades. But as he tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North, he recently found himself in a musical discomfort zone.
Very recently, I played in a really beautiful festival in Ireland, the Boyne Music Festival. And I was playing my usual classical music and solo things and chamber music and so on. And I was invited to join in with some traditional Irish playing musicians, the amazing Zoe Conway, who's a fiddler, and her husband John McIntyre, both of them, I think, really famous Irish musicians. And she had written various pieces of music, and she said, you know, would I play with the group or with her? And she had everything written down on paper. And so we started to rehearse the music. And I suddenly realized, you know, normally I know exactly what I plan, every nuance, I plan exactly how I'm going to work with classical music. And now with this traditional Irish music, I'm really in out of my comfort zone. So I was admiring amazing playing that she was doing and the extraordinary complexity of this music, which, you know, it's folk music, but it's somehow very, very complicated. Rhythms are very complicated in groups that keep changing from groups of 7 to 11 to 15 and back again. And I'm listening to her completely comfortable playing really, really fast and joyously in this music. And I had to fit my rhythms, very, very simple rhythms, into that. And I suddenly realized, wow, this is something completely different. I mean, it's a very, very different way of playing. And although I'm playing the cello and I'm still trying to play very, very simple rhythms, just having this complexity around me, I found exciting, but very disturbing. I'm on the edge of my seat trying to fit in all the time. And then, you know, as I went along, I was realizing you just have to let go. You just have to allow yourself to play in a way that normally, I have to say, I don't allow myself that freedom. I'm I express music in the way that I want to express it, but I don't completely let my hair down and just sort of go with the flow and see what happens. And that's really unusual feeling for me. I must say I was really quite taken aback.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm thinking, you know, as you know, I love Irish and Scottish traditional music, and I spend a lot of time listening to it. And I know a lot of musicians who play it. And a lot of them, I'm going back to something you said at the very beginning, which is that she wrote down parts for you. So many people who are playing that kind of folk tradition don't write things down. You know, this is all done by ear, or it's done That's by right. chord charts, or it's a combination of those things, or everyone knows the tune and they say, okay, we're going to play this in D and go. And everyone just kind of goes. And I imagine that that is a very different experience from the kind of training and just playing experience that you have.
Yeah, completely different. And actually, I think Zoe was trained classically and then moved into Irish fiddle playing. So I think that gave her these skills to write down her songs and to understand exactly how they could put onto other instruments. But definitely the way it looks on paper. I mean, I was looking at the paper thinking, oh, this is incredibly simple. I just have to play a few bass notes and here's a couple of nice melodies. And then suddenly I was in the music with her playing. And I couldn't even sometimes understand, you know, normally you know where the first beat of the bar is. You know, that's the kind of obvious thing in classical music. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. I mean, that's how it goes, you know. And suddenly I had to wait a few bars and then I was supposed to come in. And honestly, Bonnie, I just couldn't tell sometimes at all where I was supposed to come in because the rhythms were so complex and the bar, you know, there wasn't a first beat in the bar. There was groups of the, like I said, groups of 7 and 11 and 4. And I couldn't even somehow always distinguish those things. They were so, so clever. And yet when you listen to the music, it seems really natural and so simple in a way. And I was thinking, oh, it's simple music. But I was so mistaken. It's not simple at all. And it really taught me a lesson in, you know, that, you know, I should never underestimate how complex this kind of music is. And you know what? The great thing about having that experience is that it makes you look at your own music quite differently. And actually, I was practicing afterwards some Benjamin Britten music, which is, you know, written in the 20th century and based also on kind of folk song ideas in a way. And I started to recognize things in the music, in Benjamin Britten's music, that is, you know, is, you could call it modern music in a way, harmonically and so on. And I started to recognize things in it that I've never seen before in all my years of studying this music. I started to notice different senses of rhythms and patterns, which I don't think I would have noticed if I hadn't done that Irish music.
I wonder, I was also thinking of Béla Bartók, who, of course, used a lot of Hungarian folk music in his works. And I wonder if you were working on some pieces of his that you might approach them differently now, too.
Well, yeah, you know, because just recently, I think we talked about it recently, I was playing Kodály solo sonata, which is also Hungarian music. But somehow, you know, when you see that music, you know it's Hungarian and it's folk-based music. But somehow this Irish thing has got into my blood in a different sort of way. And you know what? Even now, I'm practicing to prepare a Messiaen quartet for the end of time, which Olivier Messiaen wrote in the concentration camp. And it's a quartet for piano, clarinet, violin, and cello. And it's Quartet for the End of Time. And so it's one of the most extraordinary pieces ever written. And it's a kind of exploration, if you like, of time that is not time. It's a kind of searching for what eternity means, or whether, you know, time exists in any normal sense. And of course, if you're in a concentration camp, you can understand all of that. Whether you're going to have a future, not have a future. And this music doesn't have any of the normal architecture or plans that classical music normally has. Every bar is a different length. There are no rhythms that kind of go with other rhythms. It's so complex, but it's really contemporary music in that way. I mean, you feel it as modern music. And now, with that experience of the Irish traditional music, I'm again looking at that and understanding time differently. I mean, just appreciating time in music in a way that I've never done. I mean, you'd think I would have thought of all these things, but just, you know, after all of these years, but you realize that exposure to something that is so, so very different, and yet within your own circle somehow, is very inspiring and really stretches you fantastically.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's using the same notation, it's using the same scales. This is not Chinese music or quarter tone music or anything like that. This is, you know, they're using the same stuff, but yet it is so very different.
And, you know, the other experience that I remember having years ago actually was with jazz, because, you know, I never trained as in any way really to play jazz. And people very often ask me, well, do you play jazz? You know, I mean, you play the cello, do you play classical music, you play modern music, you play Baroque music, you know, all these things. Do you play jazz? And I always have to say, well, no, because I didn't train. And it really feels like a very different beast when you're playing the cello. To play jazz, suddenly you just need to have understood how the structures work, and like you were saying, you know, the groups and the changes that can happen spontaneously, and how much jazz is not written down, and so on. But I do remember having this experience. it was on a cruise ship, actually, and I was on a tour, and part of the concerts were on the cruise ship. And there was one night when it was particularly rough, and most people were probably back in their cabins, and some people walking around, and I noticed that there was a young lady playing piano and singing really gorgeous jazz in the bar, and there was nobody there. She was just on her own singing, and I happened to walk through, and I sat down and listened to her. And then she said, oh, aren't you one of the musicians, you know, do you want to, you know, play along with me and play some jazz? And I thought, you know, I said to her, look, I really can't do that. I just don't have that kind of those skills. And she said, oh, well, you know, there's nobody here. Why don't you just come along? So I went and got my cello and I started. And I said, well, can we at least play some of the songs that I know really well? Because then I can sort of improvise in a way and go along with what you're doing and respond to what you're doing. And I won't be totally out of my depths because I know those songs so well. So she said, fine. And we chose a few songs and I started to play, and gradually I started to kind of let my hair down and stop thinking in the way I do normally as a classical musician, having everything planned out, knowing what I'm going to do, and just literally playing along, playing the flow of the music, getting involved in some of the melodies some of the time, and rhythms and harmonies, but just allowing myself to, in a way, use my subconscious memory of the music to play along with the music. And that probably sounds like I'm very confused explaining this, but it really is such a strange thing to do when you've spent decades planning every single note you play. So it started to go reasonably well. I mean, I can't say I was actually any good at it, but I started to enjoy it a little bit. And then some of the other musicians started to arrive into the bar, and I felt absolutely appalling. You know, I was so embarrassed about what I was doing. But, you know, they said, come on, keep going, Robert. You know, you can do it. You know, and I was doing my best, Bonnie. That's all I can say. But it was one of those weird experience that, you know, playing the cello is my life. Being on the platform is my home. I'm so comfortable doing what I've been doing all my life. It is the place that I'm probably more comfortable, you know, professionally than I, in any other way. So to have the cello and to be playing music and to feel so incredibly uncomfortable is a true shock to the system.
Well, you know, it's probably a good thing. Because as you said, it makes you approach your everyday music making with fresh eyes and fresh ears, maybe, and maybe a body that's responding differently to rhythms or harmonies or whatever. It kind of, you know, opens you up to new things.
And you know what? Just remembering that, you know, playing with Zoe Conway, you know, she's fiddling away and her knees are jumping around with, I mean, she's sitting playing and her knees are bobbing up and down with different rhythms, really fast, left, you know, one foot's going with one speed, another foot's going with the different beats, and it's like her whole body is caught in these complex rhythms. And just seeing somebody working with music in that way is really enlightening. It just realizes that you know, I never really think of music with beats like a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, just super fast counting like this all the time. I never work with music that way, but I can see that she was doing that even faster than that. It was part of that kind of music where the rhythms and the beats are, you can actually work with them at that speed. And even just that detail, watching her bodily moving that way, was fascinating.
Did you have a chance to talk with her at all about her transition from classical training to doing more traditional stuff?
Not really. I mean, we were rehearsing and then the concerts, and I didn't have a chance to talk about that progression for her. But very clearly, when you look at the way she plays, she holds the instrument, not in, you know, it's a very trained, very organized classical way and very, what we would call very beautiful, very poised and very clear for good technique. Not at all sort of like somebody's picked up a fiddle in a bar and they're just playing it. I mean, she looks very, very refined in that way. But it's given her a fantastic facility, you know, really amazing technical facility. So clearly it's worked with her, you know, both ways. But then, you know, if you look at great, great jazz players like Oscar Peterson, for instance, the great Canadian pianist. He trained classically before he went into jazz, and jazz was his life. So I think, you know, there are different disciplines that you learn from each. And I'm actually really intrigued to go back and try and do a bit more Irish. In fact, Zoe said to me, said to the audience after one of the performances, it's Robert on trad cello, she said.
Well, I was going to say, Robert, if we see you here at Irish Fest next year, we'll know the transformation is complete.
And I've got plenty of work to do before then, believe me, Bonnie.
I would love it. I would love to hear you play that, because as you know,
you challenged me now completely.
That's right. It's on the radio. But, well, Robert, have fun with that. That just sounds like a delightful thing to have been exposed to. And sometimes that discomfort is exactly where we need to be.
Right, so.
In the meantime, have a wonderful month, and
thanks.
We'll catch up with you next month, and have fun with those jigs and reels.
Thank you, Bonnie. Brilliant to speak to you.
Cellist and Lake Effect contributor Robert Cohen joins us every month in a segment we call On That Note. If you find your way to WUWM.com, you'll find a complete recording of the Mason's Apron that Robert recorded at the Boyne Music Festival. The other musicians in the ensemble were Zoe Conway on the fiddle, John McIntyre guitar, Rita and Ashley Manning violins, Carmen Flores viola, Julianne Manning cello, and Christopher Lawrence on the double bass. After a short break, contributor Jennifer Fields tastes some Wisconsin history. That's next when Lake Effect returns in a moment, here on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. What if you could actually step back in time and taste a bit of history? Stephen Apfelbaum has a way. Apfelbaum is the founder and chairman of Applied Ecological Services, a 40-year-old ecological consulting and restoration sciences firm headquartered in Broadhead, Wisconsin. The company determines what a piece of land historically looked like, what plants were there, what the topography might have looked like, and then uses that information to create a faithful replica of what was once there. Back in July, Apfelbaum tells our material culture contributor, Jennifer Fields, that reinvigorating an ecosystem can also be tasty.
Applied Ecological Services grows about 800 species of native plants in a location called Taylor Creek Restoration Nursery. Historic plants of the prairie wetlands, savanna forest, and river lake ecosystems thrive in about a 500-mile radius of southern Wisconsin.
Turns out about 60 of the species that we grow were historically consumed by Native Americans as primary foodstuffs. You know, wild rice is one of the obvious species, but the native prairie grasses were also consumed, and the Native Americans made something called a pioli, which was a gruel, as best as I can understand and describe it, made of the seeds of many native plants. It turns out several of the species that they ate, I have had interest in for decades, and just started producing those species as part of the restoration on the farm where we live near Broadhead, Wisconsin. And I started harvesting those species seeds, cleaning the seeds, and then grinding those seeds into flour and baking bread and doing cookie production with that flour product.
After a lengthy process, Apfelbaum received FDA approval for humans to consume products made with two of the native grains, Virginia wild rye and Canada wild rye.
These are long-lived, deep-rooted native plants. You plant them once. And in the case of Virginia wild rye on our farm, we have plantings that we did in the early 80s that are still viable. And without any fertilizer, irrigation, herbicide, or pesticides, we get good seed production, good yields, high-quality seed every year, and have from the same population since the 80s. Canada wild rye doesn't live that long. It'll live maybe 10 or 15 years. So we have the same experience with Canada wild rye on our farm.
Apfelbaum is a scientist, and while he may make a pretty mean cookie, he thought it best to turn to the professionals when it came time to actually tasting the flour produced from these wild grains.
The first time I introduced several key chefs around the country to these flour products, the two of the chefs literally took a tablespoon of the raw flour and put the tablespoon of raw flour in their mouth and didn't talk for 4 or 5 minutes. They simply kind of chewed and tasted and chewed and tasted. And then they opened their mouth and started explaining the flavor tones.
While the chefs picked out tones of rye and oat, the nutritional analysis was a jaw-dropper.
The protein levels in both of these native grasses range between 23 to 28%. And normal wheat is about 14%, can go as high as 16%. And then, you know, normal wheat flour and most of the normal hybridized and commercial industrial grain flours really don't have balanced nutrients and balanced micronutrients and trace elements. They're usually deficient in zinc and boron and iodine and a whole range of things. It turns out these native plants, in addition to having, you know, nearly 10% or more protein, they have a very, very well-balanced trace mineral and trace nutrient profile, and it's substantially higher than any of the commercial grains. So from a human nutritional perspective, these wild native plants haven't lost their nutritional value and like the domestic grains have.
I'm down for anything that can make pizza or cookies a healthier food choice. However, the benefits go well beyond my selfish desires.
So the first benefit of perennializing a landscape with these long-lived, durable, deep-rooted native species that is you're creating a disturbance maybe once every 10 years or once every 20 years on the landscape associated with planting. As the population might be colonized by other species of plants, we would plow it up and replant it. So planting every 10 years or every 20 years rather than annually like corn and soybean and wheat and other commercial grain production requires, really has significant conservation benefits. You know, less soil erosion, infiltration of water rather than more runoff of water, less erosion. If there's the soils aren't disturbed, there's less vulnerability to wind and water erosion. And that's just the very beginning, because these native grasses have all sorts of co-evolved and adapted wildlife that require these species. So, you know, the magnificent butterflies and birds and small mammals that gather the seeds of these plants and use them for overwintering, like a really cool mouse called a meadow jumping mouse, which is gorgeous. That animal requires these seeds and other plant and insect as its primary foodstuff. With a crop that's perennial, it also changes the economics of farming and doesn't require the farmers to go out and spend money on all the, you know, the chemicals and fertilizers and expensive seed corn every year. They would buy this seed once every 10 years and install it and basically manage by mowing and doing prescribed burning and then harvesting.
According to Applebaum, the long-term goal is to create and produce edible products. Should these products make it to market, the proceeds would be used to create an endowment to fund future conservation efforts.
Jennifer Fields is Lake Effects Material Culture Contributor. She spoke with Stephen Applebaum, the founder and chairman of Applied Ecological Services in Broadhead, Wisconsin. Our interview first aired in July. We'll take one last break, but stick around. This time we have music performed in our Studio C. Lake Effect returns in a moment with Milwaukee-based singer-songwriter Kaylee Conway here on 89.7 WUWM.
Oh, my heart and soul, did I beg to be adored?
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee-based singer-songwriter Kaylee Conway has been on the scene for quite some time, but it wasn't until the last couple years that she started releasing music under her own name. Her latest EP titled Surrounded Middle was released earlier this year. It's an intimate look at Conway's worldview, underscored by a group of musicians she continues to work with. Conway and her band will perform this Sunday at the Cactus Club, but first she joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers for an in-studio performance and conversation.
Heart and soul, I fell in love with you. Just like a fool would do.
Heart and Soul by Kaylee Conway. Thank you so much for joining us here in studio.
Thank you for having me, Joy.
So Heart and Soul, that's actually from your latest EP, Surrounded Middle. When last we spoke, you were actually working on this EP.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a bit about it.
It was a fun process. We recorded it at the Chair Company, which is a studio. And the idea was that it would be more of a live record that we could perform live and have it pretty much sound like the EP.
Well, and every time you've come into studio with us, it's always been you and your guitar.
Mm-hmm.
What is it like, you know, taking it from you and your guitar and this very kind of intimate performance, you know, singular performance, to bringing in all these other people?
It's cool. It's kind of wild. I'm glad you asked that question. There's more components to be on top of. You know, communication is a big one. And I was trying to describe, because someone asked me recently whether I like performing solo or with a band more. And I definitely haven't decided, but I would say with the band, if it all goes well, there's a much bigger rush and, like, more gratification, I would say, because you're sharing in the sentiment that you are trying to emote with other people who are empathizing with you by playing very skillfully and tastefully, and that feels good. And then there's also just like relaying the songs to other people with a group behind you. When it goes really well, like there's nothing like that feeling. But there's just more that can go wrong. There's more components of communication that can slip. It's much more expensive, which is why I play solo a lot of the time, because I don't have to pay anyone. But yeah, I hope that gives you a sense of what it's like, because that's what you asked me, right?
Yeah.
What's it like?
What's it like?
It feels good, but it's harder.
Well, and there is an intimacy to your music itself. It feels very personal. And so I have to imagine that inviting other people into that space is in some ways, it must feel a little vulnerable.
Yeah, definitely. I have issues with trust over my music, big time. So I'm trying to proactively work through that. But it's very vulnerable. All kinds of things running through my head, like hopefully the band will want to play this song. But I've definitely grown in that aspect. There's vulnerability, but that's the best way to create anything, I think.
Yeah. So the next song that you have for us, it's called Your Wedding Song. Mm-hmm. Is this something that you've kind of workshopped with your group?
Not yet. I actually just sent them out an email this morning because we have a show coming up next Saturday on September 7th with Marielle Allschwang's duo and Shane Leonard from Eau Claire. And sent them an email this morning being like, hey, do you guys think we could learn this song in time for the show? So I'm not sure if it'll happen. The song is actually recorded and mastered and is ready to be released hopefully in November. I'm working on that.
Nice. Well, let's hear it.
Okay.
I'm having all our friends at it. Pull teeth and get them there grinning. Let's get me off of their backs and hands. I'm cynical and you're different, and I'll never change my mind on you. I'll never change my mind again. Long as I live, God is my witness. Mind on you. I think I cracked the couple's key. You're warm and I'm lazy, honey. I've been buzzing half the day. Forgive the lush in me. All I have wanted in life, you deliver me. Making me still. Making me hold still forever. My witness.
I take in the lake, squint and listen. Long Michigan and endless. I'm so isolated. Our friends will line up one by one, and I'll never change my mind on you. I'll never change my mind again.
Your Wedding Song by Kaylee Conway. I have to ask, was that written for someone's wedding?
It sort of was in a very hypothetical instance in my mind that would never materialize. If I'm the character in the song, it's my wedding song, but the wedding probably shouldn't be happening because the person isn't ready. So I don't know if the "your" is sort of trying to like defer some accountability for what you're about to do, or if it was just my, you know, kind of getting ready to deliver wedding songs to people for their ceremonies. It was a working title and it just never changed.
It seems like it felt like it fit. So, you know, this is a new piece that you're working on, and I'm sure you're working on new pieces all the time. Mm-hmm. As you've started to release specifically songs under your name, how do you feel like your work has evolved?
I think it's evolved a lot. Instrumentally, I would say it started evolving because when I realized I didn't have a band at all at first, it was like, okay, well, I'm going to need to fill more out with my guitar and have the guitar have a little, just be a little bit more lyrical and more of an interesting accompaniment. So that started a little bit of a different guitar style, I think, whereas before I was kind of just playing chords and letting the ideas of my group like fill in what the instrumental melodies would be, I guess. I feel like I can write and I'm not limited in what I can imagine the instrumentation might be. There's always practical limitations, like, oh, would I be able to afford four trombone players in order to perform this? But also, one of the biggest things is that I've started teaching myself how to record and mix and stuff like that with the help of some good friends. So I'm able to kind of further imagine instrumentation and place it with MIDI instruments. And then if it makes sense to try to render it into a more serious recording, I can ask friends to just like lay some stuff down. So definitely less limitations in terms of instrumentation. In performing under my own name, I am making an effort to, you know, proactively book gigs that I want that will help with either exposure or like paying my band and touring a lot more. So there's an awareness that I have to be able to deliver the songs solo.
You mentioned, of course, doing a lot of different things, pushing yourself as an artist, but you're also involved in some other organizations. Specifically, you mentioned Sing Me a Story. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, they have a database of all of these handwritten and hand-illustrated stories. They have like PDFs of them by young children who are either in hospitals, hospice centers, or shelters, as I understand it. So these kids are in need in various ways. And the organization calls out to musicians. I think it's across the country. I don't know how they found me, But they hit me up probably last year at some point about what they do and if I would want to, you know, be an artist. And I looked at the stories and it was like, well, yeah. I mean, first of all, it's for a good cause. And second of all, as we were discussing before the on-record interview, I like to kind of contort and jam in other people's songs and words into my work. So like Heart and Soul, for instance, and the Christmas music that I do, it's very, I feel like sort of fitting in pieces of the songs that already exist. So this is another kind of cool exercise in that. It's like, it's pretty unadulterated expression, I would say, when a kid writes a story. And I think that that's, if we're serious about what we do as songwriters, that's like what we're really hoping to achieve, is like the vulnerability of a child and the directness, mixing in imagination into our songs as we cry out for others to relate with us on an emotional level. So yeah, I just thought that this story, it was short and it reminded me of myself. It's called The Most Unforgettable Day by a young girl named Juanita. And it's all about going to the park on this beautiful, hot summer day with her family. And like, she just had the best day ever. You know, like they played and they laughed. And like, I remember going to the playground with my family and going on bike rides. And it was like, whoa, this is so amazing. So that's why I chose that story.
Well, Kaylee Conway, I'd first like to thank you so much for joining us here in studio and sharing your work with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And this is The Most Unforgettable Day.
Juanita went to the village with her family. Walking and talking with her family. Juanita went to the village with her family. They played games and played on the swings.
Kaylee Conway is a Milwaukee-based singer-songwriter, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Conway and her band will be performing this Saturday at the Cactus Club alongside musician Marielle Allschwang. You can find our previous conversation with Conway and Allschwang at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Bonnie North and Joy Powers join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Trapper Chef. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Mayan Silver and Chuck Kornbach this week. And we also welcome our new intern, Maggie Holdorf. Lauren Sigvason is our digital producer, Jason Reevy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks for tuning in today. I hope you can be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. A fruit.